Hi, and welcome to the Unfiltered Podcast with me, Joe Warner. In each episode of the Unfiltered Podcast, I interview the most respected, celebrated, and controversial experts in the fields of health, fitness, nutrition, well-being, and performance to help you find the life-changing advice you need to live smarter. Remember, you can find all of our exclusive Unfiltered documentaries, video interviews, and investigations at unfilteredonline.com and the Unfiltered Extra YouTube channel. And now, on with the show. James, you've been a nutritionist for what, 20 years now? So you must have seen an awful lot come and go over the last couple of decades, nutrition crazes, supplements, all sorts. But I wanted to start by asking you about almost kind of like the tribalization of nutrition. It feels now that maybe because of social media that everyone's in one sort of nutritional camp and there's one way of doing things. What's your take on this kind of polarization or tribalization of nutrition? Is it something you saw coming?
Yes and no. I think it's strange because I guess as humans we're tribal anyway. We pick a team or a tribe and we run with it. It's a bit of a shame really because it does tend to erode any discourse that you want, because you need to have conversations. Maybe this works better, maybe that works better, and it's not black and white with nutrition. Everything merges into each other. So I think coming from the standpoint of plant-based only, and I get all the ethical reasons with animals, that the animal, I completely get that. And as humans, we are quite a disgusting species. We're destroying the planet and doing absolutely terrible things. But I think with that hat on, take that hat off, what's the best diet to follow from a holistic or performance or just a health benefit? And from my perspective, animal proteins are vital. Because they provide, and get away from the farming methods and things. If you had a ethically farmed, beautifully raised animals that are massaged every day or that are really well looked after from a purely nutritional point of view and specific vitamins and minerals and micronutrients, from my point of view, red meat is a superfood. For one, for an expression, because the animal does a lot of the work. And I can give you an instance of that. So if we look at just vitamin A, we've got broadly two groups. You've got beta carotenes that come from plants and retinoids that come from animals and animal sources. The conversion of this, I mean, humans, we're extremely poor, but we're quite poor at eating a carrot or something that's got beta carotene and converting into the more, not necessarily beneficial, but it does have a few more benefits than regular beta carotene. So the animal in many ways does that for us. Then we eat the animal because we are quite poor. There's a gene associated with the conversion called BCO1 and various other genes that convert beta carotene. This is very simplistic, beta carotene to retinol. So if you've got poor variants of that, you could eat an abundance of carrots or peppers or other things with beta carotene. You're going to find that you're going to be quite poor having the active vitamin A in your system. And then we've got heme and non-heme iron. We've got B12. We've got choline. There's a whole raft of nutrients out there that unless you're really on the money being a vegan and you're supplementing religiously and you know your supplements and you know the bioavailability of different nutrients, you're going to find it quite hard. But then coupled on that, internally, genetically, you might be quite poor at converting those. So even if you're a meat eater and getting plenty of B12, if you've got certain SNPs, which stand for single nucleotide polymorphisms, within the MTHFR gene, you might not convert and utilize B12 effectively anyway. So you could be having a steak every day and you might notice that your blood B12 levels are what would be deemed as acceptable within the reference range, but you might not be feeling the benefit. You might feel lethargic still, quite tired, all the symptoms of showing a B12 deficiency, but your blood work, and we need to remember blood is a circulatory test. It shows you that you've got that nutrient there, but it doesn't show you if you're actually utilizing it at a cellular level. So that's why a DNA and a nutrigenetic test is quite beneficial from that standpoint. So, but yes, we definitely need to eat more fruits and vegetables. But from my point of view, animal proteins are very, very useful.
I want to get onto the specific tests and pick your brains over what more of us should be caring about in terms of our own, you know, unique genetic makeup. But before we do that, I just want to ask you about the carnivore diet, because you've talked about meat and the importance of that. I'm seeing more and more people, again, amplified by social media, doing all types of food apart from typically red meat. What's your take?
Again, some people can probably really thrive on it. And again, this is an individual thing. We can't give broad brush. Well, we can to a certain degree. Drink plenty of water, get a good night's sleep. There's generic advice that does work for everybody. But the carnivore diet, and I've seen lots of data on this. I know lots of people that have tried it, and they've seen a complete uptick. But that might be the same uptick as people see when they go on a plant-based diet. So they remove all the crap out of their diet, no processed food. They're just eating. They get on that bandwagon of having lots of fresh vegetables and fruit. So they get an uptake of nutrients. They're getting rid of the rubbish out of their diet, and they feel absolutely amazing. They're like, wow, this is what I've been looking for all these years. But then as you gradually go along, there's certain nutrients that might be missing in the diet that you're going to start feeling a little bit worse for wear. So I think, again, some of us are probably more geared up to having being on the carnivore diet and can probably thrive on it. Some people might feel absolutely horrendous. Likewise, some people can probably thrive on a plant-based diet and other people might feel absolutely horrendous. So you've got to try and find the right diet that suits you genetically and holistically. And that might take a bit of time, to be fair.
Can you tell me a little bit about what Mudu does then and how it helps to picture people in terms of, I guess, most of us are walking around oblivious to what we need and how we respond to different types of, not just nutrition, but exercise and stress and myriad other factors. Can you give us kind of your whistle-stop overview of what your company does?
Yeah, of course. So from my point of view, being a nutritionist, I wouldn't say the last 20 years, but there's different tools in your armory you can use to better ascertain what a client or an individual needs to thrive. So historically, it's always been a blood test, and that's been the gold standard. But blood tests are quite a 2D option because, again, they're a snapshot in time. They're circulatory tests. They show you what's in the blood. But just because something's in your blood doesn't necessarily mean you're converting it, actually utilizing it. Okay, so where that Mudu comes in, we use a couple of branches of science. So we use an area of nutritional genomics, which is nutrigenetics and nutrigenomics. Where nutrigenetics comes in, it shows you all humans, we've all got roughly the same DNA, and we share about 22,000 genes. So if we've got the same DNA and we share the same genes, why are we all different? Well, each of those genes has got a multitude of variations, and some of these are plainly obvious to see because we all look completely different, eye color, hair color, how tall we are. But there's also variations that affect our ability to absorb the vitamins and minerals in our food, how well we sleep, how well we cope with stress. So we analyze your DNA, and we provide quite an in-depth report of different health insights showing you that you might not convert vitamin D or magnesium or selenium. You might not be very good at converting and utilizing saturated fat from a weight gain or weight loss perspective. So we give you little snippets around genetics, and we try to simplify it as best we can because genetics can be fairly confusing. It's genetics, genomics, genes, DNA. It can get very, very confusing. But I think the area that we are now moving into, which I think is going to be a bit of a game changer, but I probably would say that, is an area of science called epigenetics. So, as I mentioned, we've all got the same DNA roughly. We share the same number of genes. They don't change from the day that we're born to the day that we die. But what does change, however, is the expression of the gene and how the gene functions on a day-to-day basis, whether that gene's turned on, turned off, turned up, or turned down. And that's a process called epigenetics and a process called methylation. So we can see this now in our testing. We can see if a gene specifically, or let's mention vitamin D. So there's a gene that associated with vitamin D called VDR, which is the vitamin D receptor. Now, if I said to you, Joe, go and have 4,000 IUs of vitamin D every day, it might show up in your blood that you've got 40 or 50 nanograms per deciliter, which is quite a decent level. It should be working wonders within the body. But then we can see the actual gene, how it's methylating. So maybe it's not being fired up that much. So maybe that dose, as much as it's in your blood, maybe you need a slightly higher dose. or maybe you need a slightly lower dose. So we've epigenetics allows us to gamify genetics, so to speak.
How, you know, you're operating in kind of like a sexy area of business at the moment, right? In terms of nutrition, well-being, tech and huge innovation. Throw into the mix AI. How is that transforming the business and allowing you to offer greater insights to customers than perhaps you weren't able to 2-5 years ago?
Yeah, with the AI side of things just allows us, the general populace is quite time poor. So our reports are, well, I've written most of it. So it's probably about a quarter of a million words, at least, if not probably more. So sitting in front of your phone or printing off as a PDF is 200 pages. People haven't got time. Some people do. Some people absolutely love it. But some people, oh, I haven't got time to be reading all of that. So the AI allows us to number crunch and pull in all of your data, whether it be genetic, epigenetic, blood. We can pull on all the data from your phone, so your steps, how well you slept. So all these metrics, you'll be able to ask your phone whatever question and it will come back with the answer straight away. So I think having a voice coach on the phone instead of text and pictures, well, you're still going to have the text and pictures, but it just allows you to go through your results seamlessly and have a basically an AI coach in your pocket. Because I can't be with people 24/7. I mean, we do lots of consultations. The consultation will probably take about an hour. Whereas the AI coach, boom, will give you the answer that you need. Maybe you've been for a run. It will pull in the data. Maybe you're not very good at assimilating electrolytes, or maybe that you've got an injury or you're predisposed to this. It will give you the recommendations that you need following that run. Or maybe you had a bad night's sleep. It'll give you suggestions for that day. Or maybe you've been in London. Loads of pollution. Maybe there's certain things you can do to negate that when you get home.
So there's tons of benefits there for the end user. But how are advances in technology enabling you at a company level to assess and analyze the terabytes of data you must be accumulating, right? How is the AI helping you to identify what really are the big rocks in terms of optimizing health for the general population? Are there any insights that you can share with us?
Yeah, so our app should be... We're launching our new version of our app probably in the next 4 months. And again, it's the AI just transforms the amount of data someone can seamlessly just get the answers. It's a bit like having a genie in the bottle. You can just ask it a question and it tells you straight. I mean, the amount of data that we get back from one individual's epigenetic analysis is amazing. It would crash most people's computers. So to get that at a touch of a button or a voice asking Siri, what, in a roundabout sort of way, what do I need to do? Or do I need to do this? I mean, aligning it to people's fridges. I mean, I see a point where in the not so distant future where you get up in the morning, go to the bathroom, it'll analyze everything from that night. It'll show you what you're deficient in. It'll send you a list of things in your fridge or things that you possibly need to eat that day to negate what's going on either in your blood or an epigenetic point of view. So you can negate, it allows you probably to have your own crystal ball into the future.
So how far away are we from that, James? Because, you know, personalization of health is everywhere, right? It's the buzzword from nutrition, training, supplementation to medicine, getting medicine that is actually going to work for you. How close are we to this, what sounds like quite a futuristic world?
Not far at all. To be fair, some of the tech that I've seen over the last couple of months, just simplistically from taking a picture on your phone of your food, or dragging all the data. I mean, it's out there already with Google's Bite Snap, but I think it needs to be slightly more advanced in relation to you take a picture of your food and it tells you the micronutrient breakdown. And also, if you can't tell from carrot to carrot how much beta carotene or whatever vitamins and minerals are in that carrot, but you can give a generic idea and a rough calculation. It's not far off at all. I'd say probably in the next 18 months quite easily.
And this move towards personalization of health, obviously, there's an awful lot of upside. Are you excited by it, or are there any things you're concerned about by this almost inevitable march towards everyone having reams of information about their own unique circumstances and lifestyle?
No, I think everyone should have more of their data, but it's just being able to do the right things with it, because there's so much, and I had to the disinformation and misinformation out there. I mean, you look at most news reports now, and 1 week red wine's good for you, next week red wine's bad for you. So it's and obviously science changes and evolves as we go. But I think the amount of rubbish that people read on a daily basis, and I don't know if it's put there deliberately or if people are just aren't well informed, but I think if you've got data about yourself, I think it'll prove so useful in the near future for people to you need to take control of your own health. You can't rely on other people. And if you've got all your data in one place and then you've got the AI crunching the numbers for you and the AI is effective and actually doing what it's meant to be doing, I can only see it being an uptick, really, because people, the NHS is on its knees, global healthcare is on its knees. I don't know what the diabetes, obesity, and all the other figures are, but they're off the chart. And I think people really need to embrace looking after their own health. And if they can get a little rewards for this, I don't know. Maybe people have tried the stick for long enough. Maybe we need some carrot. Maybe people need to be incentivized, maybe from a tax perspective or rewards or tokenomics or which crypto or whichever avenue you want to go down. But I think if people could see that they're going to get rewarded for improving their health, which in the long term, it's going to save us billions and billions and billions of pounds in working with the NHS, then I think it's only probably a good thing. I mean, there's a company, I can't remember who they are in the US, that if you meet your sleep goals for that month, they give you an extra $100 in your paycheck. So if you can apply that to steps, diet, if you could earn an extra, I don't know, £300-£500 a month just from being healthy, then I think most people, well, I'd like to think most people will probably jump on board with it.
I think it was Whoop, wasn't it, who started doing that for their employees, which leads me nicely onto my next question, because one of the common complaints or criticisms around Whoop or DNA testing services is that they're targeted at the worried well, the people who obsess about their health and maybe it's not actually the most helpful situation for them to have more information, which leads on to kind of, you know, cliche of paralysis by analysis, just too much data and not able to really see the wood for the trees. Yeah. What's your comeback to those two criticisms, James? Is there any validity in them?
Definitely. I mean, I work with a lot of athletes, and I mentioned this at a talk that I was at in Geneva a couple of weeks ago. And there's so much data that people just don't know what to look at. But I think everyone's got certain areas of their health that they probably gravitate towards. I mean, bad back, bad knee, headaches, sleep. There's always something that people, I don't want to say moan about, but people have got different areas that they need help with. So if we can make that as easy to understand and they can actually see, okay, the recommendations that they suggested, they've actually worked. Because there's nothing worse than getting, I'll give you an example. My other half, she just can't sleep at all. I mean, I can fall asleep on barbed wire. It's not a problem. I think it's a superpower for me. I can just sleep anywhere. I'm basically a human baby. I need my bottle. I need to sleep and I need to be fed and I'm fine. Whereas she just can't sleep. And I've tried, honestly, I have tried absolutely everything. So if you can find a win for someone, for instance, if I got her to sleep well, then she'd probably go, oh, wow, okay, now I've got a bit of a bad knee. So we'll try the bad knee next. Oh, that clears up. So if you can empower yourself, I think it would enrich the population tremendously.
And what about overcoming the obstacle of getting this kind of technology into the hands of people that need it most? So I mentioned kind of the middle class worried well, the people who might have disposable income who can afford these services.
Yep.
But they, again, generally speaking, they're obviously doing a lot to take care of their health already. How do we get this kind of technology into the hands of people who know nothing about any aspect of health, well-being and nutrition, who are the ones who would ultimately benefit from it the most?
Yeah, so when we first started, the price point is still probably, well, a little bit too high in relation to where it would be in a couple of years' time. But if you think when the full genome, when that was first sequenced, it cost around $1 billion. Now you can full genome someone for a couple of £100. So I think as the costs come down, and I'm not going to say it would be a throwaway item by any means, but if it can get all of this health data and all this health advice for next to nothing, so that the government or who, I mean, people aren't trusting in the governments too much, but if you could get the local GP or your local football team, your local rugby team, your supermarket, maybe to align your shopping slightly better, discounts on your shopping, there'd be various revenue streams, different ways of tackling this for people. It's just needing to find the right way of addressing it. But I think as the cost comes down, people see more benefit, because I don't know what the numbers are for companies in the US DNA testing and genomics testing, but it's in the hundreds of millions of now. So I think I think most people, when they see the benefit, and I think people now understand DNA and genetics after COVID, everyone's heard of RNA and the viruses, and they've got to had a bit of a brief, well, DNA testing, they've had a brief acquaintance, I guess, but mainly from an ancestry point of view. So if you can flip that on its head and talk about health, I think that most people, look, there's always going to be people that won't, but I think as more it becomes more in vogue, I think most people will probably adopt it. I would like to think anyway. And they're using DNA testing and genomic testing along with your baby book. So any newborn baby will be given a DNA Bible, hopefully. They'll have a genomic test and show you what different diseases they're more likely to develop or ailments. So I think once it's given from birth and you've got this book, then I think more people are likely to adopt it.
I was interviewing Professor Michael Snyder, the chair of genetics at Stanford, who said a vision of, as you say, babies being tested or even an embryo being tested to identify the entire genome and then almost living your life with your own unique playbook of what you should do to optimize every facet of your health and well-being. Is that a vision? Is that a utopian vision you share or a dystopian horror story that a lot of people are going to run away from?
I can see why people are probably quite scared of it. Cloning people and all, you've got this on one side of the coin, it sounds very scary, but on the other side of the ethical coin, it's wonderful. I'm more on the, I wouldn't worry about it. You should always tend to worry about things, especially with your data and genetics and gene editing and everything else that's going on behind the scenes and humans trying to play God. That can be quite worrying, but the amount of help it can give it, provide us as a species, I think it's tremendous.
Talk to me about Face Age, because I was reading about this service you offer. I've never been more intrigued by something, but less willing to give it a go for fear of the results. Can you paint me a picture of what this service is and how it works and ultimately what it's going to tell users?
Yeah, simplistically, all you do is you take a picture on your phone, making sure the lighting is half decent. I'm probably a bit dark in here, but it analyzes various metrics within the face, wrinkles, eye bags, pigmentation of the skin, hydration. The AI number crunches it and provides you with an age that the AI presumes that you are. Mine is, I think it was within 2 years. I think I'm 45. I think it said that I was 43. And then another time when I wasn't looking quite so healthy, it said that I was 47.
Well, that was going to be my next question. Does it ever tell, people living in this day and age that they're younger than they are?
Yeah. I mean, we've had, I don't know how many thousands of people have used it now, but it's quite good from a cosmetic or a facial skincare routine perspective, I guess, telling you, because most people are massively dehydrated. A lot of people drink plenty of water, but they don't seem to realize that just because you're drinking water, you're not actually getting hydrated because you're flushing all the electrolytes out of the system. So just because you're consuming the fluid doesn't necessarily mean that you're quote unquote hydrated. But it just gives you tips and things to follow, some advice, and it's fairly useful.
Based on all of the information, all of the data you've got, and I know it's never as black and white as this, James, but lifestyle versus genetics, and we've touched on epigenetics already, but where is that ratio? Where is the needle in terms of what are going to be the most significant factors that ultimately dictate how long you or I live?
Yeah, I mean, your genes, to a certain degree, are the deck of cards that you've been dealt, but you can negate sometimes for their effect. I mean, just because you've got fantastic genes, it doesn't guarantee that you're going to live to a certain age. I was actually having this discussion with my sister earlier, because both sets of my grandparents have lived to late 80s, early 90s. My granddad was sponsored by gin and tonic. He did. He used to drink half a bottle of gin every day.
Wow.
So yeah, I'm surprised he lasted until his mid 80s, really. But they do. Certain genes do predispose you to having a slightly longer life, but there's certain landmines in life. If you're smoking, if you're drinking, eating bad food, highly stressed, not getting enough sleep, then those genes are probably going to be negated. And likewise, if you've got certain genes that are going to predispose you to, I don't know, heart disease or having certain ailments, again, you can negate for their effect by eating having a healthy diet, getting plenty of exercise, not drinking any alcohol, not drinking heavily. But I think the genetic side of things is at least it allows you to see which cards you've been dealt. So you can hopefully put different recommendations into place and hopefully offset them.
So when we hear about, you know, the little old lady in Italy who's lived to 120 on nothing more than a bottle of red wine and a packet of cigarettes a day, are these just genetic outliers who have just been dealt the perfect deck of cards and then just basically been able to get away with whatever they've wanted to do?
No, it could be. I mean, there's a little old lady, I mentioned this a couple of weeks ago, that when I used to work helping with cardiac rehab classes, she was 103. Dots was her name. She looked like Baby Yoda. She was tiny. She used to drive there in her little Mini Cooper with a pillow on the seat because she couldn't see over the steering wheel. She would have a McDonald's a couple of times a week, and she'd have a shot of whiskey before she went to bed. So I don't know if she did that through her life, her whole life, or when she got to 100, she thought, oh, well, I might as well do what I want. But I think some people have got certain genetic gifts, and she obviously went with them.
In terms of what people can do once they've done a genetic test, a DNA test with a company like yours, and then they've got all this information in front of them, I imagine, you know, it's not going to come as any surprise to anyone that regular exercise, good nutrition, adequate sleep and stress management are going to be the really big rocks. But from all of the findings that you've got and all of the research and the data that you have access to, are there any kind of surprising things that people just might not be aware of that are having a greater influence on their health and well-being than they give it credit for?
The main ones that I do always say that people do tend to overcomplicate health. I don't know whether because new things come in vogue and things that this is slightly more sexy. And the main things, like you just alluded to, getting a good night's sleep, eating a balanced and healthy diet, making sure you're hydrated and so on and so forth. But most people, and again, I spoke about this a couple of weeks ago, most people tend to overlook vitamins and minerals. They probably know what they are. They know what vitamins are, and to a lesser degree, probably the minerals. But I don't think people fully understand how important vitamins and minerals are in the diet. Vitamins are slightly easier to get because plants manufacture them through the photosynthesis. It's the mineral content, because our farm soil's being farmed and farmed and farmed and farmed. The mineral content is depleting year on year. And without the minerals being there, they're like the spark plug in a car engine. The vitamins, in many ways, can't do their job. And most, if not all, a lot of diseases that were initially thought to be genetic years ago were actually from a vitamin and mineral deficiency. I mean, most people have heard of scurvy. You've got pellagra. You've got beriberi. You've got shingles. So there's a whole raft. And if we use that same methodology to other ailments, then I think as the vitamins and minerals run out of the body, that's when you're going to start having real issues. So I think from our point of view, the data that we've seen, the things that most impact biological age, being hydrated, weight training 3 to 4 times a week, reducing stress obviously is a massive one, taking a multivitamin, there might be a placebo, but and again, it depends what multivitamin you have, because there's a whole raft. You've got Centrum on one end, which nobody should really take because they're awful. And then you've got things like AG1 that are very, very expensive, and lots of things in between. But I think people, again, from my point of view, once you've had a genetic test, addressing the vitamin and mineral deficiency risks in your report is crucial. It's really important.
And is it as simple as taking a multivitamin? Because as we touched upon earlier, you might have certain genes that mean that maybe you're not able to synthesize, or whatever the correct term might be. Is this where knowing how your body responds to certain vitamins and minerals is so influential? Because then if you know that you're not very good at absorbing it, or whatever the correct term may be, you might be able to find other ways of taking it, a vitamin shot or whatever.
Yeah, no, completely. It's just the information. I mean, taking a multivitamin, again, depends what type you're taking. You've got to look at the bioavailability of the nutrients in there, the quantity, because there's a lot of vitamins and minerals that just you're given virtually nothing per pill or per in the powder or in the formulation that you're taking. I see taking a multivitamin as, I guess, added insurance. That I know that I'm getting a certain degree every day, then I use the food as value added on top of that. But I think, yeah, I mean, we should be launching our own range of supplements quite soon. The last 7 years, we've been trying to stay brand agnostic, because the last thing we want is people thinking you're only giving me a supplement, because you only give me a genetic result because you're going to try and sell me a supplement afterwards. But we've been hounded now by so many people. Can you bring out a multivitamin? Can you bring out this? Can you bring out that? Because I'm a bit of a supplement snob. I see most supplements on the market are horrendous, and it's probably a good thing now that Amazon have clamped down, saying that if you're going to sell supplements on Amazon, you need to show the efficacy, you need to show where it's from, you need to show that it's actually in the pill or the capsule, because a lot of people sell supplements and they say there's 400 milligrams of magnesium in there. There might be only 100. So you don't know. There needs to be some sort of regulatory body that looks after the supplement industry, because I wouldn't say quite so much now, but years ago, it was a bit like the Wild West. You really didn't know what you were getting. And to a certain degree, when doctors are a bit of a mixed bag with this one, they seem to think taking a vitamin, all you're getting is expensive urine and you're peeing it all out. And some doctors think, no, taking one, but it depends which type you take. So again, it's just an extremely large and quite broad grey area that we need to address.
In terms of other supplements that have proven, in your experience or in your wisdom, have proven health benefits, for instance, what are you taking? Are you taking creatine? Are you taking omega-3s? Are you taking vitamin D? Can you just talk me through, because I think people are so confused by dietary supplements and especially the sports nutrition side of things as well. What would you rank as your essential in your supplement stack?
So my top five, I would say magnesium would be definitely top five. I take creatine every day, five to 10 grams a day, depending if I'm training or not. I don't take lots like I used to years ago, but I'm taking more from a holistic point of view now. Creatine is very, very important in the methylation cycle, like we were talking about earlier. I think people just seem to think creatine, and rightly so, it's been the rock star of the supplement industry for the last 30 years, and the performance benefits are well documented now. We don't need to go through them, but now there's more of a holistic and a well-being angle to creatine. It helps with inflammation levels as well, massively. But I'm taking it from an anti-aging point of view. I take vitamin D in the winter. Don't take it so much in the summer. My blood levels have been pretty high, so I'm not taking as much as I used to. It was mainly around the COVID time. I was taking an abundance of nutrients too. I was a bit of an experiment on myself. I was hoping to get COVID, so I could prove everyone that I could tackle it with vitamins. And I contracted COVID, felt awful for 8 hours, took my little COVID stack, and I don't know if it was that or my immune system, but I felt better the next day.
What was in your COVID stack?
So I had an abundance of zinc. I was taking 1,000 milligrams of zinc every 4 hours. I was taking tonic water. I was taking ECGC that's basically an ionosphere that allows zinc to go into the cell. Zinc's a bit like a vampire, needs to be invited in. So to get the zinc into the cell to stop the transcription of the virus. So I was taking abundance of that. I was taking lots of vitamin D3 anyway. And I felt fine. I think it was my immune system mainly, but I was getting I had plenty. I mean, we had a lovely summer that year. I think it's 2020. So I was out sunbathing most of the day. So my vitamin D levels were through the roof. What else to take? N-acetylcysteine, NAC, and glycine for GlyNAC, the combination of both to help, basically produce more glutathione in the body. I've been taking that for years. Omega-3s. 2 grams a day. So there's various things that I take religiously. I've been taking them for the last 10 years.
The whole wellness longevity arena has been sort of taken over recently by these longevity crusaders, typically coming out of the US. I'm thinking of the likes of Brian Johnson has gained an awful lot of attention. Aubrey de Grey, obviously somebody from the UK, and David Sinclair, just among a plethora of characters now, touting how we can all live for not just another 10, 20, 30 years, but potentially 500 to 1,000 years. Yeah. I'm interested in getting your take on these longevity crusaders. What do you make of them?
On one hand, I appreciate what they're doing because it's getting eyeballs on the industry and getting more awareness around it. I'm always a bit dubious of people that they're saying this is the secret sauce. And then, just happen to be selling the secret sauce as well. And it's an interesting one. If you look at Dr. David Sinclair, he's probably, I'd say, Brian Johnson might have overtaken him now, I don't know, but Dr. David Sinclair has been the rock and roll star of the longevity community for a long time. And unfortunately, a lot of his findings haven't been able to be replicated by the scientists, which is a bit strange. I mean, resveratrol, it might have other key benefits, but from an anti-aging, sirtuin activation, no one else could replicate what he was doing, which is a bit worrying. And then the same things happens with his dog formula. I think it's called Leap Years. I can't remember what it's called. Again, very smart, because everyone loves their dog, probably more so than themselves. They spend more money on their dog than they will themselves. So NMN, improving longevity in dogs, and that wasn't found either. So it does send the alarm bells ringing a little bit when two nutrients that have been touted and both can't be replicated by other people. It just puts a bad taste, and it looks quite bad for people looking in on the industry that it's, and I don't think that he's a cowboy by any means, but I think he means well. He's doing it from a place that it's coming. I think he's fairly genuine with what he does, but it leaves a bad taste in my mouth. And specifically when he's launching other supplements, and I see these supplements online, and the price point, they're absolutely extortionate. And you look at the nutrients in there, and then maybe because I'm slightly more well-versed in the supplement industry and I know how much specific compounds cost, you can't sell something for £80 a month when it's costing you £3 to make. It's just disgusting. From my point of view, it's not very ethical at all.
I think there's a lot of people would say somebody like Brian Johnson, someone who's gone off and made a ton of cash in business, absolutely up to them to do whatever they want to do with their life. And if they want to share their findings, you can take it or leave it. With somebody like Dr. Sinclair, who is professor, you know, in the Department of Genetics at Harvard, that is an esteemed career that a lot of people will take him far more seriously than the likes of Brian Johnson because of his academic credentials. Is that a greater cause for concern when we've got incredibly high profile and esteemed academics maybe muddying the water somewhat? And I don't want to put words in your mouth, James, but I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, it can be. If we look at science in general, I think cash is king at the end of the day. I don't want to say it, but you can buy and get whatever result you want if you're paying enough for it, I'm sure. It is a bit of a grey area. I mean, look at all the court case now with, what's his name, Fauci over in the US. He's being pulled apart in the Supreme Court for all of his, what should we say, made up suggestions. The 6 feet, just made that up. Everything seems to be made up, and it does leave quite a bad taste in your mouth. I wouldn't claim to be a scientist. I have various science degrees. I've got a keen interest in longevity. And from my point of view, it's just lying and just allow it. It just is. It's not good for the industry. It's not good for science as a whole. And we understand science is evolving. You make mistakes, rectify those mistakes when things new things come out. I get that completely, but just lying about things continually, it's not good for the scientific community, I don't think.
With longevity, there is obviously unimaginable upside if we can genuinely find a cure for aging as the ultimate goal, but in the meantime, just helping people live longer, healthier, happier lives.
Yeah.
What needs to happen to ensure that the conversation can keep moving forward and the waters aren't muddied by, you know, actors with maybe aims or business interests that can confuse things? Because I guess we don't want to see the longevity conversation descend into the kind of mudslinging we see around nutrition.
Yeah, that's a real concern. You start getting tribal with longevity, you're going to get the plant-based community, maybe the longevity community, that will section off, and they'll, if it's all getting, not franchised, if it's getting completely torn apart by different fractions, it's going to be a real issue. So we need to make sure that doesn't happen. And I think people just need to, but I don't know, maybe it's just society currently. Everything's so polarized. I've never actually known anything like it before in my life. It's quite worrying, really. If you've got the specific outlook on life, or you've got that particular walk of life that you like to follow, and you don't agree with the people over here, then you're completely demonized. And it's really weird. It's not, I think because everyone's so stressed following COVID, it could be that. Maybe there's a lot of anger that needs to get out of people. I don't know. But from a longevity point of view, we just need the best minds coming together and pushing us forward. I mean, it's quite an interesting one. If immortality, living forever, I mean, if you have that, then the planet's going to get massively overpopulated. What's going to happen then? Is it, do you get to a certain age and there's going to be a random lottery? You've pulled the card now, so you're going to have to get. It's really strange. I can't see where it's going. I mean, I can appreciate that most of these longevity doctors and on the premise of immortality will only be available to the millionaires and probably the billionaires amongst us. I don't think the average person will be able to afford some of the technology that will push us in that direction in the foreseeable future, I wouldn't have thought. And I don't know, would you want to live forever? It's a bit of a weird one, really.
Thank you for listening to the Unfiltered podcast. If you've got this far, I hope you won't mind if I ask you to leave a 5-star review when you get the chance. We'd really appreciate it. And don't forget, you can access all of our exclusive Unfiltered video interviews and features at unfilteredonline.com and the Unfiltered Extra YouTube channel. See you next time.